Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. This week I'm speaking with Arjun Makajani, President and Senior Engineer at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Arjun is the author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a roadmap for US energy policy produced in 2007. This unique publication is the first analysis of a transition to a US economy based completely on renewable energy without any use of fossil fuels or nuclear power. Carbon Free and Nuclear Free has been circulating among members of Congress in the United States, and now under President Obama, there is great potential for the country to take a huge step towards a cleaner, safer future. Arjun Makajani, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Helen. You played such a big role in bringing carbon-free, nuclear-free about. You inspired it. You know that.
Thank you, Arjun. Now, we want a political update, basically. I think we should start with the stimulus package just passed now by the U.S. Senate and then and House. And then we want to go on to what is happening in the federal Congress and what is happening around the state. So can you give us your analysis of the stimulus package from an energy perspective?
Well, we don't know yet exactly what is in this compromise that seems to have been agreed on today, today, the 11th of February. But I looked at the provisions in the House part of the bill earlier on, and many provisions are very good. The federal government is going to be buying electric plug-in hybrids in order to improve the efficiency of its fleet. It is going to invest in energy efficiency of its own buildings so as to reduce federal energy consumption. It is going to help utilities invest in a smart grid. Eventually, the ambition is to put 40 million smart meters in homes and in buildings. There are about 130 million residences in the United States and another several million other structures. And so this will be a huge step. Putting smart meters is a very, very important step.
What is a smart meter, Arjun?
The kind of electric grid that we have today, Helen, it's a one-way conversation. The consumer flips the switch, and the electrons are waiting at the switch, and the electricity flows through the device. And there's no communication between the consuming device and the generator other than the flip of the switch. You flip it on, it has to come on. You flip it off, it goes off.
Right.
This is a very inefficient and wasteful way to do things and very costly for renewable energy. For example, if you have wind energy and air conditioning requirements, there may not be wind in the daytime when you need your air conditioning. So if you have a smart meter that's plugged into an ice-making machine, and such a thing is available on the market today, and that ice-making machine is connected to a laptop through the grid, then you could make ice when the wind blows, so you're storing coldness. And then when you need air conditioning, you get your air conditioning from the stored ice. It's like the old ice box, except it's a very, very modern version, and sitting inside the building, you would never know that you're getting your cool air from ice rather than from a compression air conditioner.
So it's a method of storing wind energy to be used when appropriate.
Yeah. So, for example, you could, in Holland, they've done an experiment storing wind energy in a frozen food warehouse. So they lower the temperature of the frozen food when the wind is blowing, and then they turn off the freezer or when the peak of the electricity use arrives in the daytime. So essentially, you have a way of storing wind energy in frozen one of the reasons I concluded that we could go to 100% renewable energy system is in the last few years, we have a very large number of approaches to overcoming the problem.
Well, this is wonderful, wonderful news. Who put together the energy part of the stimulus package? Do you know the main authors of that?
No, I actually don't. You know, this has happened like a whirlwind in Washington.
Yeah.
It happened very, very rapidly. But I think President Obama's goals about this were very clear from the beginning. You know, I don't know about the other parts of the package. I think the energy part of the package may be about 10-15% of the package. It's not clear how much. But it will be probably around $100 billion. That's a lot of money. It's a very, very good start. And the thing we will need is efficient implementation.
$100 billion.
That, I think, how we're going to spend this money to actually improve efficiency, measuring that, getting the smart meters done, putting them in the right places, all of that still, you know.
So now I know that there was a $50 billion package for the nuclear energy industry. Do you know what has happened to that yet, Arjun?
Well, the Senate Appropriations Committee put in a provision for $50 billion in loan guarantees for a new energy facilities.
Yeah.
We believe that most of this would go to new nuclear power plants or plants to convert coal into liquid fuels. And we don't know what has happened to it in the final package that has been agreed to, but I suspect it's still in there.
Oh, dear.
This has been a very closed, difficult process. You know, with very, very little access from the outside. Partly, you know, one understands that the speed of the thing that has been necessary, but also it's been very, very intensely political, of course. You know, Republicans have mostly opposed it and Democrats have mostly supported it. So all of the compromises that have happened in that have not been around technical issues as much as how do you get the right number of votes. So I suspect it's still in there, but I'm not sure.
Yes. Well, did the House go for it?
Well, that we don't know that, Helen, because we don't know whether this we don't know what's in the final package. It's just the news that there's been an agreement has been announced.
Yeah.
Almost no one knows what's in it.
Okay. Now let's move on to Dr. Chu, who is the new energy czar or Secretary of Energy, coming from Lawrence Livermore Labs, which is a nuclear lab appointed by President Obama. Tell us about him, Arjun Makhijani.
Well, he doesn't come from Lawrence Livermore, actually. He comes from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab,
Lawrence
which is
Berkeley.
Just above the hill from the University of California, where I got my doctorate.
Yeah.
Now, that is not so much a nuclear lab and is not really associated with the weapons complex. There are some things related to nuclear fusion and so
they
on
do,
that happened there. But actually some of the finest work on efficiency of buildings and some of the finest energy research has been done there. And Dr. Chu, who headed the lab, actually was responsible for starting up whole new programs in biofuels and energy research that had nothing to do with nuclear energy.
Mm.
Now, he is a supporter of nuclear energy on the record, but that's not the area he seems to have been most enthusiastic about in his work. He signed on to reports by all the laboratory directors within the Department of Energy laboratory complex saying nuclear energy would be a good thing, and he's even signed on to reprocessing of spent fuel where plutonium or transuranic radionuclides would be separated and used as fuel, which I think is not a very good idea at all. Dr. Chu is actually a little bit new to the energy field. He came to the energy field a few years ago. Before that, he was primarily a physicist. Of course, he got a Nobel Prize in physics. And I think he will undoubtedly have to do quite a lot of thinking in a completely new context in Washington. Which is not just driven by research and development and the kinds of concerns that laboratories have. Here, he will have to worry a great deal about proliferation. How is what he does does in the department connected to what President Obama might do in his negotiations with, say, Iran, for example? How will the demand for reprocessing go up in other countries if the United States goes that way? So I'm actually fairly sanguine about Dr. Chu and also about President Obama's science advisor, John Holdren.
Yes.
Because even though Dr. Holdren has been for nuclear energy, he's been against reprocessing generally, to the best of my information. And I think that they will do some sorting out. I don't believe that the Obama administration will go in a big way for nuclear power.
No.
President Obama had said during his campaign that they are not going to go for new nuclear power plants unless the waste and proliferation and safety issues are addressed. Now, we don't know what that means, but we know that they are not addressed. The
Yes.
Yucca Mountain Repository is a horrid place. President Obama doesn't like it, and he said so in writing. There is no alternative plan for spent fuel as yet
Yep.
in the United States. So I can't see how he can fulfill his campaign commitment and just plunk down for nuclear power right away. It's not going to
No.
happen soon anyway.
Yes, and I know Dr. John Holdren, and I think subliminally he really doesn't like nuclear power either. So that's very interesting. Now let's...
Well, he's been very explicit in terms of his reservations about
yeah,
it, and
yeah.
but he feels in the context of the seriousness of the climate problem, perhaps it should be left on the table and we should try to address its deficiencies. But I think, you know, people who are aware of the deficiencies of nuclear power are not generally very enthusiastic about it.
No.
So the nuclear renaissance is going to need a lot of enthusiasm. It's not going to happen by itself.
And a lot of money, federal
of
money.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to the Congress. Tell us, Arjun, what your contacts have been in the Congress, both the Senate and the House, and how they've progressed with your wonderful carbon-free, nuclear-free roadmap for America by 2050.
Well, last year we had quite a lot of congressional contacts, as you mentioned at the start of the program. We distributed a lot of copies. We met with some senatorial and House staff people and discussed carbon-free, nuclear-free. Last year, legislation wasn't going to go anywhere, and so we didn't put a huge effort on the Hill. Mostly we put our efforts into building up the carbon-free and nuclear-free alliance and putting movements in place in some states to get 100% renewable electricity sectors in some states. So this year, I think we're going to make a bigger push. President Obama energy or climate plan is to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 80% below 1990 levels by the middle of the century. I think if you parse those numbers, what it means for the energy sector is it's going to mean more than 90% reduction. That's almost all the way to a completely fossil fuel free economy by the middle of the century. I think, you know, we certainly are going to push for going to 100%, but we haven't yet begun our efforts. Now, we have a very good situation on the Hill, as you know. Congressman Waxman is chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee. He's very strong on climate protection. Congressman Markey, whom you know so well, and I also know somewhat, partly through you, is chair of the subcommittee that will oversee the introduction of climate legislation. So I think we're very, very well positioned to have strong legislation on climate and also well positioned to prevent massive new subsidies for nuclear. And whether that's going to happen or not, you know, and ultimately what goes into the sausage making in Washington is always a little bit uglier than what you might imagine.
Yeah, so don't eat sausages.
And so part of our effort is going to remain at the state and local level. I'm trying to convince utilities to just face the music. Now that we're going to have 80% CO2 reduction, those who don't get with the program are going to face huge costs. for carbon payment. And they just need to bite the bullet and say, we're going to live in a renewable world, and we have to figure out a way to get there. And certainly yours truly is willing to help them.
So in the stimulus package and Obama's bill, is it just what you recommend, Arjun, which is to tax or charge companies emitting carbon dioxide to the tune of maybe $100 to $200 a ton, emitting it into the atmosphere with no trading? First, talk about your idea and why you think that's the most efficient thing, and then discuss what you think maybe President Obama is advocating.
Well, what I advocated is a single national market for carbon. That is, you decide how many tons of carbon will be allowed to be emitted nationally. And, you know, we can't go to zero overnight, unfortunately. So we have to ramp down. And then those allowances should be sold to fossil fuel users. And every year you have a smaller number of allowances until it goes to zero in 40 years. And holders of allowances should be allowed to sell them to others who might need to a bit more efficient themselves. They may have a surplus.
So there is some trading in your scheme.
There is some trading, but very, very restricted. Now, what I think is likely to happen in Washington, and to some extent, what is already happening in the regional state-level compacts for carbon trading that have already been put in place, the much more complex system that allows sale and purchase and of credits, carbon credits and offsets and many other ways to claim that you have reduced your carbon emissions, some legitimate and some very difficult to verify. I'm very worried that a cap-and-trade program can cover a lot of sins, especially if international trading is allowed.
Yeah.
And that has been the Achilles heel of the Kyoto Protocol.
Yeah.
It has allowed some places to claim they are reducing carbon when they have just shifted the pollution to developing countries which don't have limits. There's a lot of mischief that can be made, and we just don't have the time or the capacity in the atmosphere to absorb more insults.
That's right. That's right. I mean,
we just don't. Every day, the signals are not good. You know, Helen, the reason I got involved in this, I completely agreed with you that, you know, this is an emergency. This is intensive care for the planet, and we need to address it on that basis. And cap and trade in this complex mode is just not serious. I'm seriously thinking that if there are these shenanigans with cap and trade, I would actually prefer that there be a tax.
Yeah.
And a simple tax.
Something
that makes the price on carbon very apparent and very transparent.
Yeah.
And low-income people can then be reimbursed. But, you know, Washington can screw up anything. Even a tax can be compromised.
Yeah, I know, and the politicians don't get the science either. I mean, they're starting to get it, but they don't get the urgency. Like the seas could rise by the end of the century by meters, and we've just had the most dreadful bushfires in Australia where up to 300 people. They haven't finished counting the incinerated bodies yet that are in the houses and the escaping cars, but it was a holocaust. It was a holocaust.
It's been a horror story just to read about it.
And many climate scientists are saying now that those conditions almost certainly were brought about by global warming. You can't prove it. Meanwhile, in the north of the continent, in Australia, we've had up to a meter of rain falling in 7 days. Meter is, nearly 3 feet. So, catastrophic weather conditions were predicted when I actually wrote my book, If You Love This Planet, in 1991. And there's a study happened. So your point that you made that we don't have time to do a Tony Soprano cap and trade scheme with I mean, playing the usual Washington or international or transnational corporation politics. We just simply don't have time.
But Helen, you know, I think this idea of cap and trade is pretty much almost a settled thing. We're going to have to try to get the best we can. My feeling is that we need to work at the state level and at the corporate level and at the individual level. And I think a lot of the innovation in going into the future is going to happen at the state and local level as it has happened in the past. If part of the good news is, you know, we talked about two people before, John Holdren and Steve Chu. I think the really good news is both of them are first-rate scientists. Both of them understand the urgency of the climate problem. They understand the science of the climate problem. And both of them understand energy questions. And so I am very hopeful that when it comes to energy policy, of translating greenhouse gas emissions into specifics of energy policy, is the government going to buy electric cars and plug-in hybrids for itself? Will the government make its own buildings efficient? Will it put up photovoltaics over the parking lots, airports, and government buildings, schools, and so on? All of these specific things are really going to drive what happens in the real world. In my book, I calculated that it should really not cost more to go to a completely renewable system if we attend to efficiency. So if the right kinds of energy policies get enacted, efficiency standards for buildings, efficiency standards for cars, I think a lot of this stuff about cap and trade may become irrelevant because it will be economical by itself to go to renewables and efficiency, and we'll have the infrastructure in place. We need the legislation to send a message that you can't go on using fossil fuels and that the hammer is going to come down and one day it'll be very costly. The shenanigans prevent it from becoming costly in the short term. They kind of push off the cost 5 years, 10 years, which is very bad for climate, but they don't let you avoid the costs altogether. So serious companies, serious cities, serious states will do better and they'll be ahead.
I'm interviewing Dr. Arjun Makhijani, who's the author of the seminal book, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. Which you can actually find and download on ieer.org. Now,
thanks to you, we put it up for downloading free, and it's been downloaded more than 250,000 times.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
It is amazing.
I'll just tell you a little anecdote. My executive director, when you first produced this document, was sitting in her bath like Archimedes, reading carbon-free, nuclear-free, and she got so excited, she nearly leapt out of the bath like Archimedes and ran naked down the street. So it's pretty exciting. Now, Arjun, tell us what you've been doing at the state and local level around the USA on this issue.
Well, I did a study on nuclear power plants, two nuclear reactors that are proposed to be built in South Texas, and then I showed that the utility of the city of San Antonio, CPS Energy, which is considering buying 40% of those two reactors, would save between $1.4 and $3.1 billion by going to renewables and efficiency instead. So how much money they would actually save. And part of it is, you know, utilities are conservative and hidebound, and they want to do things in the same way. Mm. I understand it to some extent. They're responsible for keeping the lights on. But we won a little victory over there because the board of the utility decided to delay the purchase by 1 year, and they have upped their efficiency investments, and they've upped their renewable investments, so I hope that this nuclear investment will not happen. I'm working with a group called Heal Utah to put in place, I'm doing a study specific to that state, as to what it will take, both in terms of policy and in terms of resources, to create a 100% renewable electricity sector in that state. We've put together this Carbon Free Nuclear Free Alliance. We have the beginnings of a website, carbonfreenuclearfree.org. And we are going to prepare model legislation for states to adopt if they want to do 100% renewable electricity sector. So we're going to begin to work in half a dozen states this year.
So how can people, that's wonderful, how can people join the Carbon Free Nuclear Free Alliance?
Well, you join the Carbon Free Nuclear Free Alliance by signing the Statement of Principles. It is there. If you go to IEER.org or carbonfreenuclearfree.org, you can sign the Statement of Principles, and you're part of the alliance. You'll be part of our listserv, as you are, Helen. Now, if you want to be an active part of the alliance, a part of our working groups, we have a state and local working group, a federal legislative working group, and an education working group. You can join those. At present, the alliance is a U.S. affair. We don't have an international outreach effort yet.
Well, I think that's important because I think that the direction that the United States sets now will set the model for the rest of the world, even for China and India. And it certainly has the capacity and the technological skills and indeed the money, even in this economic depression climate, to do just that. So I think working in the United States is the most efficient thing to do, Arjun.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, this was a kind of a joint decision we made at the start of the project when you inspired it and say, Arjun, you have to do this. But I am going to begin to work a little bit in other countries this year.
India? Your
India,
home country?
I hope to do a short report on India and maybe one or two other things that are in the work that I can't talk about publicly yet.
Right. So that's wonderful, Arjun. Are you being funded well for Carbon Free Nuclear Free?
Well, we certainly could use some contributions. We are doing quite well considering the very, very difficult economic climate. But in this climate, nothing is secure because, you know, many of the foundations that fund us have taken hits. They have lost a good bit of their capital. They're going to, you know, so we don't know, you know, one of the foundations. Anyway, you know, things are more uncertain this year. And if you want to contribute, you can go up to IEER.org and send us a contribution or send us a contribution in the mail. We'd very, very much appreciate it. Institute for Energy and Environmental Research.
Yes, I think that people should support this, the Carbon Free Nuclear Free Roadmap, because I think I would compare it in medicine to the discovery of penicillin, which happened
during
the Second World War and totally revolutionized the practice of medicine because for the first time we could cure infections. Well, you were the first to see and cost out and look at the technology required to produce virtually no carbon and no nuclear by 2050 for America.
This little vignette will interest you, Helen. Yesterday there was a discussion at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation in Annapolis here, and Peter Bradford, whom you know, is there, and a spokesman for Dominion Energy, which wants to build two nuclear reactors, was there. And so all of us made presentations, and someone in the audience asked the spokesman for Dominion Energy, do you have any problems with what Dr. Makijani has said in his presentation, 100% renewable energy? And he said he had no problems with it, but he still thought nuclear energy should be in the mix.
Well, these people are refractory.
So I was pleased that even a utility representative had to admit there are no problems in what
I'm
proposing.
Still want to spend, you know, $12 to $15 billion for each reactor now.
We'll have to work to stop them.
That's
not going to be easy, but we can do it.
We can do it, and with the help of everyone listening. So I'm encouraging you all to join Carbon Free Nuclear Free, for those who can, to contribute towards this ongoing imperative work. And I thank you, Arjun Makijani, for joining us today. And we'll be asking you to come for updates every few months so that we know what you're up to and how you're leading your revolution in energy policy.
Thank you, Helen.
Thanks very much, Arjun. That was Arjun Makhijani, President and Senior Engineer at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Arjun is the author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for US Energy Policy, produced in 2007. You can download a free copy of the roadmap from ieer.org. You're listening to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and now I'm joined by Paul Collins, an Australian historian who's written 11 books, including Burn, the epic story of bushfire in Australia, which was published in Australia by Allen and Unwin in 2006. You can obtain this by going to Amazon.com in the US. Here in Australia, we've just experienced the most devastating bushfires in our colonial history in Victoria, a southern state of Australia. Over 200 people perished on February the 7th, 2009, a day that is now known as Black Saturday. Hundreds of properties were lost and millions of wildlife were killed, and over 7,000 people were displaced. Paul Collins joins us now to give insight into the history and impact of bushfires in Australia. Paul has taught history and theology in Australia, the US and Pacific countries. Paul Collins, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Helen.
Well, you wrote this sort of prophetic book in a way in 2006 about the history of bushfires in Australia. And although this is for an American audience, but also an Australian audience, I think it's tremendously relevant now to talk about bushfires, or as they call them in America, wildfires, because there's a drought afflicting particularly California, but other states, and we're very much affected by drought in the southern half of our continent in Australia. And it seems most likely that these effects are because of global warming. So why don't you, Paul Collins, give us a history of our continent, when white people landed here and took it from the Aboriginal population, the history of the use of fire by the Aboriginal population, and what's happened since then in our history?
Well, that's a tall order, Helen, but I'll have a go.
Yeah, have a go.
Well, Australia was first settled by Europeans, specifically by the British, in 1788. The first fleet arrived in Sydney Cove in 1788, and the people that the British brought were a very large contingent of almost 1,000 convicts. And convict is the term used for prisoners in the British penal system. Now, these people varied. Some were quite serious criminals, and some were, I suppose, what we'd call pocket handkerchief thieves. That is, they pinched, they were minor property crimes. When they came, they discovered in possession Aboriginal people. Probably, estimates of the Aboriginal population at the time of European settlement varies, but it's probably somewhere around the 800,000 mark. Now, the settlers commented from very early on that the Aborigines certainly burnt sections of the country. And they didn't detail specifically which sections were burnt, but it has become obvious from fairly detailed research on Aboriginal burning by subsequent scholars that most Aboriginal burning occurred in open country, not in forests, in open country, in grasslands, essentially. The purpose of the burning, there are various speculations as to the reasons why Aborigines burnt, but it may have been as simple as of just opening up the country so that it was easily accessible to them. Their burning was a very light form of burning. It was actually quite carefully thought out and managed. It assumed traditional patterns. It was light burning, and it was never a wildfire in the sense that Australians experience it today, or people in the United States would experience it in, as you said, California and the western part of the USA. And I think that's very important to keep that in mind about the Aborigines, because an enormous debate has begun in Australia over kind of burning of the country to prevent wildfire. And the people who are very strongly supportive of this kind of preventative burning always say, well, of course, we're only doing what the Aborigines did. Now, So I think, keeping that in mind, and keeping in mind also that the Aborigines never burnt forests.
And how long, what was their occupational time here? Was it 40,000 years?
Well, again, that's a very debated issue, but John Mulvaney, who is probably the best scholar in this area, who's really the pioneer of Aboriginal history in Australia, Professor John Mulvaney at the Australian National University, estimates 45,000 years.
Yeah.
However, there are other estimates that go as high as 60,000 years, so you can take your choice, and it's probably somewhere in that ballpark.
Right.
Well, keeping that in mind that they didn't burn forests, and remember the forests in Australia are mixed forests. The predominant vegetation is eucalypt. There's about 700 species of different species of eucalypt in Australia.
And Californians know eucalyptus trees very well. They're a bit of a weed there.
That's right. Well, it started as a weed in Australia. In the original forests of Gondwana, the great southern continent, they were originally, of course, beech forests. They were very much the kind of primeval forest that we tend to think of as, you know, covering Europe and so on and so forth. So they were mainly beech forests, and the eucalypts began as a kind of a weed at the edge of our beech forests. But gradually the eucalypts took over as the continent dried out, and as it moved further north from the Antarctic
with continental drift. Mm.
And so the eucalypts gradually became predominant, although we still have quite a bit of a rainforest in Australia still preserved. We have the largest tract, for instance, of cool temperate rainforest in the world, although vast areas of that have been destroyed.
By fire.
By fire, exactly. And so as the British kind of settled here, fire became a primal means of clearing the landscape. The British brought with them a kind of European industrial agriculture, and so in order to bring that about, they needed to clear the land. They also brought, of course, sheep and cattle, hard-hoofed animals who compacted the soil much, much more than it was with the soft-hoofed animals, the marsupials, the kangaroos, the wallabies.
Macropods.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Look, it's good to have a scientist with me who can give the right terms, because, I'm a historian and it's easy to kind of get mixed up here for an amateur like myself on these scientific questions. But fire became really the primal way of clearing the landscape. And in fact, I argue that it by the late 19th century had become a kind of a form of initiation into manhood. You weren't a real man, and certainly not in rural Australia, if you hadn't gone out and fought the bushfire.
Oh, really? I didn't know that history.
Well, you find it in there's a famous, very well known to most Australians, probably very few Americans would have ever heard of him. But a bloke named Henry Lawson, who was both a poet and a short story writer, he's a much better short story writer than a poet, but Lawson kind of presents the kind of fighting the bushfire. Ironically, of course, the bushfire having been lit by settlers, going out to fight the bushfire as a kind of a form of initiation into manhood.
Mm.
And a kind of a rural myth grew, which was basically that you had to kind of burn all the time in order to keep combustible material down.
Yeah.
And but of course, the irony of all that is that the more you burnt, the more the combustible material grew. And so we've in Australia have got into this incredible vicious circle of kind of burning in order to prevent fire, burning in kind of during spring or in the fall, in order to prevent fire, but in the very process, allowing the growth of combustible material that feeds the next fire. And my estimate is that that in terms of fire on the continent, I mean, we have increased it, you know, I mean, it's impossible perhaps to put an exact figure on this, but in my view, we've probably increased it 50 to 100-fold. The continent was never burnt to the extent that we are burning it. And as I said, fire in the forests, in the eucalypt forests, and certainly in the rainforest, was much rarer than it is now.
And of course, now we realise that millions of tonnes of CO2 are ejected into the atmosphere, which all adds to global warming. So it dries out, there's a drought, the woods are tinder dry, they catch light from lightning or man-made fires, and we're just adding to global warming. So then everyone, it's so hot, people go inside and turn on their air conditioners, which are run by electricity and coal, which adds to global warming, and HCFC gas, which actually also destroys the ozone and is a global warmer. So it's such a...
It's a vicious circle. Oh. There's no two ways about it.
Tell us, Paul, do you know any of the history in the United States of... Did people burn the land there like we did?
Quite honestly, I don't know the answer to that. The person who... I mean, the great historian, if you like, of world fire is Stephen Pine. And Stephen Pine is at the University of Arizona, at least that's the last place he was at. He's also written a history of fire in Australia. His is a much more scientific history. Mine is a more popular history, if you like. Mm. And I tend to go into, although Pine also considers a lot of the social aspects of fire, I perhaps go into that in more detail.
And what is his classic book called, Paul Collins?
His classic book is on Australia is called Burning Bush.
Well, what about his classic book on the history of fire?
I was afraid you were going to ask me about that. Honestly, I'm quickly looking at my bookshelf while we're speaking, but I just can't spot it. I do have it
and
here.
I can't find it, but it's P-Y-N-E, isn't it?
Yes, it's P-Y-N-E.
So people can Google it.
That's exactly right. And he'll come up pretty quickly because he's a fine historian. And, I've read most of his books, and they're fine books, beautifully written books, too. He's a very elegant stylist
of
English language.
Well, here it is, this Still Burning Bush, 2006.
Yes, well, that's his most recent his most recent book. He did have another book earlier than that called Burning Bush. They're the two books about Australia, but then he has a history of world fire, and he also has looked at fire in the United States.
Well, now, Paul, I'm interviewing Paul Collins, a former priest, actually, who's a very noted historian in Australia and has written this wonderful book, Burn, The Epic Story of Bushfire in Australia, published in 2005. Paul Collins, let's talk about the recent catastrophic holocaustic fires that have just occurred in Victoria, our southern state. What happened, how it happened, and what is happening right now? I mean, it happened, I think, just over a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and the fires are still burning. So can you graphically outline for the audience what this really means and what it was like?
Well, Victoria is the second most southern state in Australia. It's the most southern state on the continent of Australia. It occupies the area in the southeast corner of the continent. Of course, Tasmania is an island across Bass Strait from Victoria, and it too, of course, is very fire-prone. But I think it's quite safe to say that even considering California, Victoria is probably the most fire-prone place in the world.
Why?
Firstly, because it had a very, very considerable forest cover at the time of European settlement. Much of that forest cover is gone, but there still is a fair amount of it left. It is much more closely settled than most other parts of Australia. It's the most closely settled area of Australia. And that means, of course, where there are human beings, you tend to have the possibility of fire because people light fires.
Mm.
The other thing is that at the present moment, it's increasingly being caught in drought because there has been, as a result of global warming, a change in the pattern, the weather pattern across the state, and there is less rain and more drought. It's just that, you know, it has such flammable vegetation, really. I mean, that, in a way, that is the essence of it.
Mm.
What Victoria suffered an enormous fire in 1939, the greatest, biggest bushfire that people had ever experienced in Australia up to 1939. Following that fire, there was an investigation that it was set up by the Victorian state government, which was chaired by a very able judge named Leonard Stretton. And the report that Stretton put in really sets out, in a way, the kind of future way in which Australians approach fire. And the reality is that while all fires prior to 1939 were deliberately lit.
Yeah.
Only, you know, perhaps 10% were the result of dry lightning or lightning strikes. Now, what happened was that after 1939, Australians began to develop a real fire discipline. That is, people didn't light fires in the open as they used to in the past. And that particularly applied to Victoria. The reality is that while still about 80% of all fires are deliberately lit, they are not now deliberately lit by sensible, ordinary people. They're deliberately lit by firebugs.
Pyromaniacs,
exactly. Arsonists. Now, the 1939 fire is important, and I mention it in the context of the 2009 fire, for one simple reason. And that is that, in a way, the fire of a couple of weeks ago, that actually followed the same trajectory as the fire in 1939. But you can do some comparisons. While the fire in 1939 was the worst thing that had ever been experienced by Europeans in Australia before, nevertheless, the 2009 fire travelled at a much greater velocity.
Mm.
It moved much more quickly. It was clearly much more intense.
Mm.
The radiant heat produced by it was absolutely devastating. So what we're now facing is not just, if you like, an ordinary massive bushfire.
Mm.
The word ordinary there, in a way, being the operative word. What we're facing now are massive conflagrations moving at enormous velocity, generating amazing radiant heat. And the reason for that, of course, is global warming. The actual temperature in Victoria was only 1 degree higher on Saturday in early February this year, only 1 degree higher than 1939. The wind velocity, however, was slightly higher, but the fire moved much, much faster. There are now estimates that this fire moved 10 kilometres in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, that is massive. And the reason why there were so many casualties is that people expected something like 1939, but what they got was a new world of bushfire.
Yeah, and their houses literally exploded and they couldn't even see the flames. So what I'd like to point out too is, because I've studied nuclear war, obviously, very intensely, it was like a nuclear holocaust, only the winds only moved at 150 kilometres an hour. I can't work out what that is in miles per hour. It's probably 100. Whereas a nuclear bomb produces winds of 500 miles an hour. The heat, I mean, everything just spontaneously burns, and it did this time too. The air literally burnt. The oil and vapours from the eucalyptus trees went up into the air and spontaneously lit the air itself. So as you point out, Paul Collins, we're dealing with a totally different animal now, aren't we?
Well, we are. Actually, the nuclear comparison is a very useful one. In fact, the 1939 fire released probably much more energy, but much in a more dissipated way than the Hiroshima bomb. But now what we're looking at, and what we certainly can compare the energy released by these bushfires, it is equivalent to a contemporary nuclear explosion, except that the energy released is much more, if you like, dissipated. Yes, I couldn't get the word there. Yes.
Well, a 20 megaton bomb, and I think the Russians still have some of them that are targeted on New York and Washington and LA and the like, produces a firestorm, a holocaust of 3,000 square miles. So where everything just spontaneously ignites, even in the middle of winter when the ground is covered with snow and ice, the heat is so intense.
Well, in Australia, I mean, for instance, in 2003, there was a quite extraordinary fire, certainly in area and in length of time that it lasted, much larger than the Victorian fires of early February. But that fire, for instance, it went across at least 10 to 15 kilometres of ground that had no vegetation on it. This was a drought-covered area. There was no grass even for it to burn. Mm. What, in fact, it was doing was burning the gases that it itself had produced, and it was burning the humus in the soil. And it covered upwards of 15 kilometres of completely bare, open country.
God almighty.
So you're really talking about, velocity and intensity that is quite extraordinary.
Well, now, for the American audience, I'm interviewing Paul Collins, who's written about the history of fire in Australia, but I'm doing it for a specific reason, because in the United States, more and more fires are occurring, dreadful fires. And I think what occurs in Australia is indicative of what will be occurring in the future in the United States. There's a very big conference on March the 2nd in Washington, and one of the godfathers, if you will, of global warming, Dr. James Hansen from NASA, is saying one of the main ways to reduce global warming and stop this dreadful progression is to stop burning coal. And we have massive amounts of coal in Australia and exporting it as fast as we can go to China, who are about to build, I think, 40 new coal-fired plants. And America burns a hell of a lot of coal too. So I think we're on the edge of sort of a catastrophic situation where scientists understand, as Dr. Hansen said, but the politicians don't get it, and they're playing politics, right, Paul, particularly in Australia?
Yes, we recently elected, 18 months ago, we elected a Labor government to replace an extremely conservative and, in my view, a nasty government under Prime Minister John Howard. We elected a Labor government led by a man named Kevin Rudd, who is now our Prime Minister. But what is abundantly clear to me is that Rudd the ministers that he has in his government, even the ministers who deal with environmental questions, really have no sense of the urgency of the situation that we're facing. And see, what it's very interesting to watch what happens after bushfires. Rudd immediately went to Victoria, having perhaps learned the lesson of George Bush and Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. He immediately went to the affected areas and was seen very much comforting the victims of the fires. But you see, what tends to happen is, and this may seem a little callous to say this, but what tends to happen is that the focus is all on the suffering people. The focus, is almost entirely on that. Ever so occasionally, the media will do a colour piece on some person who is out there trying to rescue native animals that are affected by the fires.
Oh, yes, that's so tragic.
But the reality is that the vase, I mean, this fire was this fire that we've just been through in Victoria, this fire was caused by a badly constructed electrical pole, and the wires got loose. They started touching each other, creating sparks. They fell down, hit the ground in grassland and in shrub, and the fire started from there. So it was an entirely human-created fire. This was not a fire from lightning. Most of the other fires in Victoria are the result of arson, of complete and utter lunatics going out, deliberately lighting fires for the thrill and for their own arcane purposes.
They're psychopaths. But what I think happens, and it used to happen in the United States, maybe under Obama it won't, but when this happens, the politicians tend to blame the arsonists, and, you know, they are to blame to a degree, the bad electric grid, but then they also blame people for not burning off. And I can't think of one person except our wonderful Green Senator Bob Brown talking about global warming and the real etiology or cause of this. They are just absolutely out of touch with science.
Yes, but you see, what helps them, Helen, is that the media's entire focus is on the pathos of the human, as Tom Berry, the great ecologist, calls it. I mean, Tom Berry talks about, I think Tom is one of the United States' greatest contributions to thought and to environmental thought, and Tom says it's the pathos of the human. He says we're concerned about genocide, concerned about suicide, we're concerned about murder, but we're not concerned about biocide.
We're anthropocentric. Just think of the hundreds or thousands of kangaroos and wombats and wallabies and snakes
millions
that were burned. It's just, anyway, look, Paul, we've come to the end of our time, unfortunately. It's a fascinating, fascinating conversation and so relevant now to our present global situation. So I thank you so much for contributing to this program.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Helen.
And we'll have you back to talk about other subjects.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Paul Collins, a historian, broadcaster and writer. Paul's book, Burn, The Epic Story of Bushfire in Australia, was published in Australia by Allen and Unwin in 2006 and is available from Amazon.com. I thank both Dr. Arjun Makajani for being on this show with his fascinating insights politically and scientifically about global warming, and Paul Collins, an ex-Australian priest who is also a fascinating historian. That's all for today. Join us next week. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.